That's jazz pianist Jason Moran. He's been called the 21st century Thelonious Monk, and he grew up in Houston, but he arrived in Boston this fall to join the faculty of the New England Conservatory. We spoke with him back in August.
You know, they have a relationship with great pianists, first of all. You know, Rand Blake is still teaching there. Fred Hirsch is now there. And so I started looking at them a couple of years ago and started visiting and coming to do some master classes and was really enjoying the feeling of being up there and kind of the open-mindedness also about the music.
Moran is probably feeling even more optimistic about his future now. He's been named one of this year's MacArthur Genius Grant winners. In fact, the Boston area is home to 7 of the 23 winners announced today. They range from a Harvard historian to a typographer who designed typefaces for the Boston Globe. Nurgis Mavrovala is also relishing the news of her $500,000 grant today. She's a quantum astrophysicist and professor at MIT, and her work focuses on gravitational waves. She describes those as ripples in space-time, and she says they could offer clues about the earliest minutes of our universe. I spoke with her earlier today, and I asked her to explain, as best she could for those of us who've forgotten all of our high school physics, exactly what a gravitational wave is.
It's a wave that radiates from some object that has lots of gravity, and it comes to us in the same way as light from stars comes to us.
And your work focuses on detecting these waves, detecting these ripples in space-time. How do you try to detect them?
So the difficulty with this task is that gravitational waves are very faint. So the way that we try to do it is we build a device called an interferometer. Essentially, you take 2 laser beams and you shoot them out to mirrors that are placed far apart, and then you just measure how long it takes the laser light to come back to you. And by looking at the time it takes the laser light to come back to you, you can tell whether a gravitational wave passed by or not.
And have you actually been able to detect some of these waves so far?
No, they have never been directly observed. These waves were predicted by Einstein in 1916, and here we are almost a century later, and we're still trying to make the first direct detections.
Do you believe one day you will?
Any day now, really.
And if you are able to see these gravitational waves, then how will that help us learn about the universe?
So the way we know about most things in the universe today are through the light that stars emit. So stars, when they're born and they die, they emit light. When they collide with each other, they emit light. But there's another messenger out there, which is these gravitational waves. So if you have things like a black hole, which really it gobbles up light, it has so much gravity, light can't escape. But even so, it's radiating gravitational waves. And so we could measure the properties of a black hole using gravitational waves, which we can't do with light.
And that actually lets you look back into the history of the universe?
Almost to the earliest fractions of a second after the Big Bang. What astrophysicists and astronomers do, we look at starlight that was radiated hundreds of millions of years earlier and is only now reaching us as observers. The light that we see from the Big Bang comes to us 400,000 years after the Big Bang, whereas these gravitational waves that we hope to see would come to us from really fractions of a second after the Big Bang. So they would allow us to look much further back in time, yes.
Nurgis, as part of your award, you've also been given $500,000. Will some of this or all of this go into your research, or are you already very well funded in your research at MIT?
My research is generously funded by the National Science Foundation. But as scientists, we always have some crazy ideas, things that we would love to try to see if this could be made to work. And they're risky because there's some chance they won't work, but if they do, the payoff could be huge. And so one of the ways in which an award like this could be used and should be used is to allow us to pursue our crazy ideas.
Nurgis Mavrovala is a physicist at MIT and a 2010 MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. Thanks for the science lesson, Professor.
Thank you, Sasha. It was my pleasure to be here.
Now from an MIT physicist to an MIT linguist. In the 1990s, Jessie Little Doe Baird had dreams in which she believed her Mashpee Wampanoag ancestors were speaking to her in their indigenous language. That language hadn't been spoken on the Cape since the 19th century, but she decided to study linguistics at MIT in hopes of resurrecting her people's native tongue. And that's what she's been doing ever since as director and co-founder of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project in Mashpee. Actually, she says it's properly pronounced Wampanoag, since there is no G sound in the language. And she now has $500,000 to help correct that mispronunciation with her 2010 MacArthur Genius Grant. I spoke with Jessie Little Dobaird earlier today as well. And what did that mean?
I said, good day, Sasha. My name is Jessie Little Dobaird, and I am from Mashpee, and I am a teacher of the Wampanoag language.
Thank you for giving us a taste of that, so we have a sense of the feel, the flavor of it. Jessie, as far as we know, this language essentially stopped being spoken in the mid-19th century. How did that happen?
There are a myriad of reasons. There, disease that swept through the nation that killed many elders and babies, critical populations for any language, economics, war, religion.
Jessie, your work has involved reconstructing this language. How do you go about reconstructing a language that few, if any, living people have heard before?
Well, actually, it's not a reconstruction process. The language is there. The first Bible put to press on this continent was printed in Wampanoag in 1663. That document alone has about 60,000 items or words in it. There are hundreds of documents written in the language.
Okay, so it's a written language, but how do you know what the language sounded like without having an oral tradition to hear?
For one thing, Wampanoag people were the first American Indian people to use an alphabetic writing system, and they used the English alphabet. So they're approximating sounds with the English alphabet. And the nice thing is, it's only one language in roughly 40 languages in a family, and a lot of those languages are still spoken. And the sisters in the family have regular, very regular sound changes that take place across them. So, for example, if I'm not sure what a particular vowel or consonant is in a verb, in a spot in a verb, and I'm making an educated guess, I can double-check the sound by looking at the word in, for example, Passamaquoddy in Maine, which is still spoken. Basically, what we're doing is reclaiming people's birthright to have their mother language. So that entails creating pedagogical materials and having camps and making recordings and working on dictionaries and grammars and the like.
I understand you've been teaching your 6-year-old daughter the Wampanoag or Wampanoag language. Does that make her the first child in more than a century to be raised on it?
It does. She hears Wampanoag language from me, from her father, from other people in the community. I'm a Mashpee Wampanoag. My husband's a Quinna Wampanoag, and we're sort of back and forth between Quinna and Mashpee. She hears it from other students, and she hears plenty of English as well, of course.
And how many people do you estimate are speaking it now?
Well, there's a continuum of fluency from novice to advanced speaker, and we have had over 200 students that have been part of this project since its inception that are anywhere on that continuum of fluency.
As part of your MacArthur Award, you've been given $500,000. How will you spend that money?
I do have some plans for equipment and needs for the project. I think I might actually consult with some of the other language partners like Northern Arapaho, Yuchi, and Sauk to see if they have any great ideas for us.
Jessie Little Dobaird is a linguist and director of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project in Mashpee, Massachusetts. Jessie, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
As we mentioned before, another local winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant announced today is a typographer. That's Matthew Carter of Cambridge, and some of the fonts he's designed are based on carvings from tombstones in Boston's old granary burying ground. You can hear more about Matthew Carter's work this afternoon here on WBUR on All Things Considered, which will be airing an interview with him. When we come back, the science of pain. New research indicates that women experience pain more acutely than men. We'll find out why. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston. Stay with us.